Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 8, 2019. This class is class 14 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This talk is on the Dukkha Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight is class 15 of our 32 class, which is really going to end up being 34 classes, because I'm going to break up next week's class and what will be class 17 into two parts, just because of the length of the sutta. But the strategic placement of these is not by accident. This is the middle of our study, and these three suttas are on dukkha. And you'll see how they all treat dukkha in a slightly different way, stress or disappointment, unsatisfactory life experiences. And they all point to dukkha. The problem of dukkha is resolved within an individual. It's not, there's nothing anywhere that you'll find here in these suttas or anything else that the Buddha teaches that dukkha is resolved by any outside agency. All rooted in understanding and a very specific understanding of Four Noble Truths. This sutta also, this is the Dukkha Sutta, that's what it's called, and it's very short, by the way.
Shucks.
And but I can do two tonight, so we'll and as I read it, you'll see that again the focus is on how I view myself in relation to the world and how I deal with stress. And again, the reason why that's important is much of what has developed during the Buddhist time and afterwards is not how to understand and abandon my own individual contributions to my stress, but how to manipulate it or how to appease it through the gods or through certain practices or anything else that simply reaffirms my commitment to maintain stress. Anytime I deal with it as an external force to be reckoned with, I've lost my mind. And so the Buddha teaches, not in this sutta, but the Buddha teaches overall that dukkha is resolved through understanding, individual understanding. The reason why I said that not this sutta is this sutta is taught by Sariputta. Some of you, most of you probably know
Anand.
That, pardon me?
It's taught by Anand. Ananda.
This one?
Yes.
Sariputta. No? Yes.
It is.
Yes. On one occasion, Venerable Sariputta was in Malacca, the wanderer Jambudvipa. Does yours not say that?
Well, that's the note that I made.
Oh, okay. So Sariputta and Moggallana both encountered the Buddha very early in the Buddha's, just post his awakening. Maybe 6 months after, maybe a year. It's hard. There's the timelines within the suttas are hard to grasp. You kind of put some things together. They came to the Buddha, so they were obviously studying with some of the same teachers the Buddha was, not really gaining resolution, but conditioning their minds in a certain way. So once they encountered the Buddha adjusted their practice really just slightly, and especially in the case of Sariputta, he really changed his meditation practice from what can easily be called wrong meditation to right meditation or jhana meditation. They both very quickly, Moggallana first, but then within 2 weeks, Sariputta awakened. And throughout the next 45 years were the Buddha's two chief disciples who did a lot of his teaching and a lot of the, even the administrative end of this burgeoning Sangha. And they all died within a very close period of time, 45 years later. So they were major contributors throughout the Buddha's life. And this is from Sariputta. On one occasion, Venerable Sariputta was in the Laka. The wanderer Jambudvipa approached with a question. Wise friend, when speaking of stress, stress is dukkha, when speaking of stress, which forms of stress are referred to? And you could, or are referred to in the Dhamma. Friend Jambudvipa there are three forms of stress. There's the stress of pain. There's the stress of fabrications, which could also be called mental stress. And there's the stress of change. Notice where all three of these aspects of stressfulness reside. Not outside. These are all internal experiences, aren't they? When the Buddha describes dukkha as dukkha is birth, sickness, aging, and death. Dukkha, suffering, is not getting what you want or getting what is undesired. And then he would always conclude that, there's sometimes some other qualifications there. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha, which means describing the five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, as the ongoing personal experience of suffering. The next two suttas that we'll be teaching on this are called not just the Dukkha Suttas. One is the Maha Dukkha Kanda Sutta, and the other one is the Kula Dukkha Kanda Sutta, the greater and the lesser discourse on Dukkha Kanda. Kanda is a Pali / Sanskrit word, which is the equivalent of five clinging aggregates. Kanda or skanda literally is translated into a heap or a stump of a tree. And that was the Buddha's way of describing this heap, this mass of ignorant clinging, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness, this heap of ignorance that contributes to suffering. And the other reference to kanda as a stump of a tree relates both to nibbana and to this is where suffering is rooted. The reference to awakening, nibbana means extinguished, as if the fires of passion have been burned out. We finally burned down this tree that was a stump in our way, is another way of looking at it. But they all resolve in this individual experience of suffering. The stress of pain, the stress of fabrications, wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and the stress of change, because we're clinging the things that we have decided are us, and we're hoping that they don't change. Because when we've created an identity over things that are impermanent and they do change, what do we, the literal experience is we're losing parts of ourselves. That's why it's so stressful. And we don't understand it. We can't reconcile it. And so we simply move from that stressful moment to the next stressful moment, hoping to some way figure out a way to maintain fabrications. And we spend a human life doing that. The stress of pain, the stress of fabrications, and the stress of change. These are the three forms of stress. Wise teacher, is there a path, a practice for the full understanding of these forms of stress? Do you think there's a path? Yes, there is a path, a practice for developing full understanding of these three forms of stress. The path is precisely the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And every teaching of the Dhamma, it's so important to actually hear these words. Of course, the Pali words weren't exactly the same as right, meaning right versus wrong, but you could just as easily call these skillful or unskillful, appropriate or inappropriate, but right or wrong really gets to the point, especially in the English language. There is a wrong view. There is wrong intention. There's wrong speech. There's wrong action. There's wrong livelihood. There's wrong effort. There's wrong mindfulness and there's wrong meditation. All of this relates to modern practice and it relates to the practice in effect during the Buddha's time. He looked at it. He experienced it. He developed all these different practices and realized that they were all aspects of the wrong side of the Eightfold Path. And upon his awakening, he understood that in order for human beings to awaken, they had to have a right path, not simply any path, not simply an agreeable path, or not simply a path that millions of people might be doing that sounds good. We needed a right path. And that's an Eightfold Path. There's nothing, the reason why I'm kind of overemphasizing, I don't think I'm overemphasizing, I'm emphasizing it, is the path itself, if we're going to actually be practicing what an awakened human being taught, it makes sense that we would practice and develop the path that he taught. we'd follow his yellow brick road rather than someone else's. That simply makes sense, doesn't it? But it's such an important point that during the entire lifetime of the Buddha's dispensation and those that were his disciples, they kept coming back to making this point. This is the path, and it's nothing else. And if you've been coming here for more than 2 weeks, you realize that I make the same emphasis, and this is where I got it from. And this is, and I learned it from engaging directly in the Eightfold Path and watching the incredible benefit from doing so. And me in the beginning, I was just like everyone else. I was still clinging to my conditioned views, hoping to continue to mix some of the things that I thought were useful or that some of my associates were doing. And even there's a little bit of guilt in recognizing that what I realize is not what my friend is doing. All of that takes some courage too, doesn't it? But it also takes right effort. It takes the willingness to recognize that this is what an awakened human being taught and actually practice it, if I want to develop those benefits. Sariputta continues. This, friend Jambhakadika, is the path, the practice for developing the full understanding of these three forms of stress. This path is an auspicious path. Those that have been on retreat know I always work in the Baddha Karada Sutta, because anytime we're practicing the Dhamma, anytime, not just here, when we go to sit on our cushions at home, we're developing an auspicious day, an auspicious practice for ourselves. When we catch ourselves out into the world and we find our mind might be reacting a little bit, and we take a moment, we practice restraint. We realize this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. We're developing that auspicious moment within ourselves. It's up to us. This is the path, the practice for developing the full understanding of these three forms of stress. This path is an auspicious path, an auspicious practice for the full understanding and abandonment of reacting to these three forms of stress and the development of moment-by-moment mindfulness. My commentary. An auspicious day is characterized by the Buddha as moment-by-moment refined mindfulness. The Buddha's words. Do not chase the past or project your thoughts to the future. Remain free of entanglements with the world and mindful of what is occurring within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Be mindful of impermanence and uncertainty. Those that do so will have an auspicious day. So says this peaceful sage. The end of the quote.
Wow.
Was that a wow? Like, wow, that really was over quick? What a marvelous sutta, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that strikes me about this is when terms like dukkha or even the English equivalent of stressfulness or unsatisfactoriness, they're almost so broad in our minds that it's still a little bit hard to, what are we really talking about? There's only three forms of stressfulness. There's the pain of stressful, there's mental fabrications or the mental stress, and the stress of pain.
Change.
What did I say? Pain twice?
Yeah.
And my right foot's hurt me a little bit, so maybe that's why. And it is that simple to see it that way and to understand it that way. Physical pain is obvious, isn't it? It's physical pain. Mental fabrications are a little bit more difficult to see until we have that framework. But we know that if we're reacting in this moment, we're stuck in a fabrication. We also know that if our view of the world is not reconciled within the Eightfold Path, we're stuck in a fabrication that's prone to stressfulness. And if we're hanging on to anything to be the same one moment to the next, there's going to be stress. We're the ones that contribute to that. Nothing else. It's not because the world is against me or I don't have right luck, or I don't have the right God watching out for me, or maybe God turned his back on me for a moment, or whatever it might be. It's none of those things. If I'm feeling stress in this moment, it's because I'm not seeing things from right view. And how do I go from wrong view to right view? Simply as Sariputta and the Buddha and many other people taught, and now your friendly teacher here, we go through the Eightfold Path. And it's just that simple. So that's my conclusion to that. Let's start with Jane, because Jane was here first. Jane, how are you tonight?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. What do you think of tonight's sutta?
It's right to the point.
It does. I'm glad you joined us.
Thank you.
Maura, how are you tonight?
I am well, thank you.
Good.
Can you hear me?
I can.
I don't have much to add. It wasn't tonight, but it was a couple weeks ago on that sutta that it finally struck me where it says, there's always different translations, but at the end where it says, like, you know, we do not cling to the future, we do not cling to the past, so the best. But this whole thing of, you know, we watch carefully impermanence and maybe you said unsatisfactoriness, but that, like, when one steps with right view, mindfulness on those characteristics, peace and tranquility are there, right? If we're looking at that, so we're not. So anyway, I was one of my recent really. I don't have a good word for it, but just something that just struck at a deeper level and has been very fruitful.
Yeah, good. Thank you, Maura. We kind of been talking about that. You hear this over and over again, and it starts fitting, and it reaches us at a much deeper level. That's the Dhamma. Glad you were able to join tonight. Good evening, Maura.
Good evening. Just before class, I was saying to John that I realize that through the impermanence of our thoughts and who we think we are, when we really analyze them, they're changing all the time. Through impermanence, and it's God bless impermanence that we can change anything.
Did everybody hear that? Oh yeah. If it wasn't for impermanence, isn't the what's the word, bogeyman? Impermanence is just impermanence, and if it wasn't for impermanence, there'd be no Dhamma. We couldn't change.
And you see, through the progress you've made through the Dhamma, that you begin to believe in your own anatta thoughts less and less.
Yeah.
By doing that, you can abandon them easier and easier, because you just don't believe in them like you used to do. You can see the other side of it.
Yeah. I'm listening to you.
Okay. And that was it, really. Just, again, it's round and round we go all the time, you know. In your mental thinking, trying to watch your anatta thoughts and dismiss them when they're appropriate. As I say, it's a round and round merry-go-round all the time, but it works. You know, you can, when you look back at how my mind was sort of years and years ago, golly gosh, I wouldn't like to go back there. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Me either, would anybody?
So that was it, really. So anyway, just saying about today's teaching, many, many times that we change and we don't think about the stress of change, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just take it in your stride, and the change is better, where you appreciate it, you know, it keeps life interesting, all of a sudden the other, but you can see what the Buddha means by change also could be very stressful.
Yeah.
Not always. And sometimes you think it's going to be stressful and it's not. You know, there's an upside to it that you weren't expecting. So change is there. To me, I get hung up on the body, you know, pain in the body. That's always me. I have to really work hard to think the body is, you know, the body is just the body that I'm in. It's not me. It's just, and okay, I've got, you know, I've cut my finger or something, and okay, I've got pain in the body, and that's it. That's always difficult for me to just dismiss and accept the thinking that the Buddha teaches on physical pain.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was it.
Thank you. Very profound. Two things I'd like to touch on there. You mentioned last week, I'm not sure which class it was, about things becoming superfluous.
Mm-hmm.
And what you were just talking about tonight, I think you would say that you're starting to recognize the superfluousness, how's that for a word,
mm-hmm.
of your own thoughts.
Yeah.
And they are. When we realize that ultimately this whole thing resolves with our thinking, with our thoughts. And recognizing that the thought constructs that I've held my whole life are simply rooted in ignorance and are impermanent,
mm-hmm.
gives me the power and the license to let go of them, because mm-hmm. I realize there's simply nothing there, no matter how much importance I might have placed on them, and no matter how much they may have affected my life, they're just thoughts, no matter what they are. And ultimately, letting go of thoughts rooted in ignorance is just that. It's not a blaming thing, like, how could I be so ignorant? It's just, this is just an ignorant thought. Let it go. There's nothing personal about it. And it's easier to let go when we see it as superfluous, isn't it? There's just simply nothing there. I think I'll let it go. That's enough commentary on that. But thank you. It's such an important point to make. Everything resolves in these three marks, and you could attach attributes of each mark to the other one. In other words, impermanence is part of not-self. Not-self is part of impermanence. They're all part of this thing called dukkha. They're all part of the five clinging aggregates, because those things are intertwined intellectually to recognize this is where these ignorant views have... These are the constructs of my ignorant views. Let them go. Thank you. Good evening, Tim.
Good evening. I've read the sutta many times, and it's short, but I'm right with Lorna on this. It's the... When I look at the five clinging aggregates and I look at... do the study of dukkha and everything, it's the physical pain... that's the one that is hard to reconcile,
mm-hmm.
because it's almost evolutionary. You know, we're meant to feel pain for a reason. And so when there's chronic pain, it's like you have to, it's always. And so with the other types of dukkha that are out there, they can be like that, but they're not, there's no evolutionary benefit for them. Okay. I'm just free forming here, but the reconciliation of the physical pain and recognizing that this is what you just said, I won't even say it again because it was perfect. It takes a lot of practice, and I'm still working on it because, it affects your ego. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're 53, what's going on? Why me? Mm-hmm. And then you catch yourself, wait a minute, this is just how it is.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been a reason it happened, but it happened. So it's now that you have to, but it's hard to reconcile. And I think if I were at that place, at that discussion during that sutta, I probably would have said, wait a minute, before you stop, can we talk a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so let's.
No.
Thank you. The pain in the body is useful, but when we personalize it, it's not. It compounds the pain. It's a lot to suit. It's great. I'm teaching that. So the Buddha taught, as a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be pain. Sometimes it's extreme pain, but none of it is personal. So again, you're right that pain is evolutionary, meaning that it's necessary for the species to continue to develop, however it develops, but there's nothing personal about it. And so I'll tell you a personal story. 4 days before 9/11, I fell off a roof. It was like a shallow 8 feet off the ground, and I had a burst fracture of L1. It was pretty bad. They airlifted me down to Robert Woods, and doctors all around me all the time, and blah, blah, blah. And I did something stupid that I always told my employees never to do, and I did it, and that's why I fell off the roof. Years later, and I'm still, in some ways, the pain is even worse now than it was back then. The point that I'm trying to make, and I hope I do make it, 3, 4, 5 years after it, when I was more or less recovered, and just to put the whole thing in context, about a year after this was over, I started being able to walk again, and I had about 5 or 6 good years where I even went out and started playing golf a little bit. But even during that time, something would hit me. The pain would come back, or I'd lose the use of a leg for a few minutes just because the nerves were messed up. And I'd have this thought, an angry and really a vicious thought, directed at myself. How could I be so stupid as to fall off of that roof? And it would pop in and out of my head for quite a long time. In other words, I couldn't get past blaming myself for something that, on one hand, you could say I deserved it because I was acting foolishly. But all of that was rooted in a fabrication. The reason why I acted foolishly was because I was trying to show up an employee who wasn't working the way I wanted him to work. It's a fabrication, right? None of it was really personal, was it? I'm not trying to say I wasn't ultimately responsible for what occurred, but not 5 years later, and not to keep beating myself up over it. And again, as I applied what I understood about the Dhamma and let those thoughts go as they came up, eventually the thought that how could I be so stupid as to do what I did and fall off a roof and break my back became superfluous to me. It simply had no value anymore. I trained myself through the Dhamma to not react to that vicious and really a self-hateful thought. And guess what? I haven't had that thought. And the pain is still here. I'm still having the benefits, the ramifications of that. But I don't blame myself for it. It's just something that occurred in my life. Like things that happen to everybody. Nobody gets through this human life unscathed, physically or mentally. You just, maybe there are some people, but I haven't met anybody. It's just the way it is. Why take it personally? But while I was compounding the initial pain. Now it's just an old body with pain. I'll get to you in a second, Michael.
I was just going to say, as soon as you say, why is this happening to me? You're reaching for that second arrow.
Yep.
You're loading your bow.
And that's just what I was doing.
Yep.
That's such a perfect suit, isn't it? Because it's just what I was doing. For years and years and years, I kept shooting myself for, you know, for what happened. Thank you. Thank you, Helen. Michael.
I'm sure you didn't plan on falling off that roof.
No.
No matter what transpired in relation to your coworker, things happen all the time.
Yep.
They happen moment by moment. Moment by moment, our reality changes. Yes?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sometimes good, sometimes bad. As you fell off that roof and lay crumpled on the ground 8 feet below, and you suffered, for an extended period of time, your reality was changing rapidly in a negative manner.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So then it's not so much, I would think, way to, I don't know, kind of like think through this in accord with the Eightfold Path and what the Buddha's Dhamma. I would think then that it's like all of us have an ever-changing reality each and every moment. So again, that is your reality at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that reality, okay, what we do in that reality, if I'm getting the message clear, okay, is to accept the reality. It is what it is. And formulate and deal with it as it lays out before us each and every moment from the point of when this thing occurred and bring this into a new reality.
Thank you. Yes, but the only I don't want to call it an argument, but I will just got to be like looking for another word. The only argument I have is talking about different realities. It's all one unfolding experience of a human life.
Yes.
It's all one reality.
Yes.
It's how I react to it in the moment that is significant. But I can't expect to be falling off a roof and immediately have a full-blown Dhamma practice integrated in my life simply because I'm falling off a roof. You understand the point I'm making? I felt like I'd hurt. I reacted with the quality of mind that I had at that time. Now I'd like to think that I wouldn't have gone to all the self-blame and all the what-ifs. Another aspect that was there for many years when I would remember what happened and be in pain and or you know some other limitation because of it, I'd have this thought was how much different my life would be if that didn't happen. And that was another long-standing pernicious thought that was just lodged in my thinking. If only this didn't happen. What a ridiculous thought to have, isn't it? But I had it. It was rooted in fabrication. It was rooted, I mean, that's the essence of I-making, isn't it? Wanting something to be different than it was. Wanting myself to be different. Wanting my life to be different than it was in that moment. And so coming to the reconciliation of the whole incident, that's the right word, didn't change what happened. And it didn't miraculously heal my back or anything like that. I just no longer struggle with what happened. Michael.
And just furthermore, so I can get a, you know, just get a little bit of clarity on this. So then, God forbid, you ever go up on the roof again.
I did, by the way.
Which is probably wouldn't be a wise thing, right? But if this, and you, what you are saying, if it did happen today, knowing what you do now and is evolved as you are, as integrated with the Eightfold Path as you are now, then you would actually have a different perspective on the situation as when you had it back in the past, would you say?
I would speculate that yes, it would be different. But I don't want to find out. But yes, I would. I mean, there's other situations have happened over the years that I notice that I'm not reacting to them. I'm not taking things. Honestly, I can't think of much that I take personally anymore, and that's such a wonderful thing. You know, people wonder how can you live in the world, but I live better now than I ever had in my life, and that's not because I got a lot of things or a lot of friends or anything. It's simply because I don't. Because nothing's personal. The only thing that's personal in my life is my dog, but that's the way it's supposed to be. That's the ninth noble.
At this point, when you see yourself doing something stupid,
a lot more.
The reaction is just, well, that was not very smart. Let's not do that again.
Yeah. Well, that's I mean, I certainly learned from it. But I hope I wasn't too dramatic about that. Mm-hmm. The point is that we by taking things personal. We, as Helen pointed out, we're just sticking the second arrow in, but continually. And we can carry it on for the rest of our lives. I could still be beating myself up or wishing that it didn't happen and how much better my life would be. What good is it? I mean, what good is it to even think that way? It's harmful. I've lost my mind. This is a true essence of mindfulness and mindlessness. Any type of speculative thinking like that or to think that I should establish myself in emptiness or nothingness or anything else or the other nonsense that people talk about is pure speculation. I've lost my mind. And, you know, we can do that 1,000 times a day. As human beings, we can still come back into reality and develop true mindfulness, what's really occurring. Maura had a question or a comment.
Just maybe two things. One, just on what you're saying about not taking it personally or something like this, that I mean, that's just classic of this is not me, this is not myself. So whatever, even the thoughts that come up around, my life would be better, this is not me, this is not self, this is dukkha. It's just a conditioned way of seeing the world as well. But I think more personally, my experience you know, living with you for many years.
Shh, don't tell people that. Just kidding. Maura and I lived together for about, what was it, 62 years? It was a long time. I'm just kidding. We lived together for about 5 or 6 years.
What can I say? So more, I think, to me, the more relevant aspect of observing you in relationship to significant pain. I don't think I've ever seen anybody in as much chronic pain, and I've worked in healthcare for 30 years, and I think your level of pain is pretty remarkably intense.
Oh, don't tell me that. I'm trying to convince myself it's not so bad. Yeah. Nothing four aspirins can't help.
The equanimity in which you dealt with that, it was clear that you were in physical pain, but your emotional reaction to what was occurring was always pretty steady, except if it was a super, super, super bad moment. But that, I think, is a more relevant thing. You know, I never heard you saying anything like, oh my God, I can't take this anymore, or this shouldn't be. You would say, it's there, it's occurring, it is what's happening. It's, you know, this is what's going on. And you know, career bows and, you know, whatever else is going on. It was, you know, you said that multiple times over the years. Those sensations are there, they're unpleasant, but that's just what's occurring, and it doesn't disturb your peace of mind significantly from my observation. It's quite remarkable. It disturbed my peace of mind way more than it disturbed your peace of mind.
Is that why you always hit the aspirin?
Exactly. Well, it's like painful to watch somebody in pain when you don't, and you don't have as much equanimity.
I didn't mean to create a painful, stressful experience for you.
That's so painful.
Thank you, Maura. Everybody say, aw. Thanks, Maura.
Yeah, looking at pain in the body as stress and not identify with it, because it's, I think that the hardest thing to disidentify with is with the body.
Yes.
It's just, you know, it's
clinging to form.
You can't get away from it.
You can't get away from it. It's always there. And we've been dragging this thing around for 60, 70 years.
That's the right word, too.
And it's... to not identify with that, it's a real magician's trick. You're pulling yourself up by the bootstraps somehow. And I do it a fair amount of time, but it's just too easy to get caught in that.
It is. But again, I'm arguing with a lot of you tonight.
Yes.
So I'll argue with you. Yeah. To me, now, and I think it's in one of my books too, it's a magician's trick to self-identify with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the magician, though. We're the ones that are playing the trick on ourselves.
Right.
Because it is completely impersonal.
We're in front of the curtain, and we're behind the curtain, and we're in front of the curtain.
Yeah.
it's confusing.
And because pain is so, and it's not just physical pain, though, by the way. People that have severe mental issues, just to put it that way, that we all know them, and I've talked with plenty of them. Some of them have come here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same pain,
mm-hmm.
you know, that type of pain. And it's very, very difficult to not self-identify with it. And maybe even more so. The Buddha says in a couple of suttas that it's easier to reconcile issues arising within our body than within our minds.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's even more difficult to step away from that.
There was this one of the great physicians who was fully schizophrenic.
Nash.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You've seen the movie, but
yeah,
this man could disidentify with his schizophrenia.
Yep.
I mean, that's amazing.
He could see it.
Yeah, he could.
Yeah.
He knew it. He could see it, and he would just ask somebody standing there, you know, you see this guy standing there in front of me? Because yeah. I can see him, but I'm just checking here.
But what was his name?
What
is it?
A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a great movie. Yeah. I'm going to go look for it. You know? And it's, you know, we can see ourselves in that same way. I don't know if you're schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
But it is just our fabrications are almost a schizophrenic view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you could almost qualify it as saying, yes, it is schizophrenic because we believe it. We take it personal. But now, you know, having some time to work through this, and it took me concerted Dhamma practice. Now when pain arises, it is an impersonal experience. And I won't say that it's interesting or fun or anything like that. It's just a better way to have pain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to describe it.
If you're gonna
have pain, which we all are going to have, and again, everybody's pain is different, levels of pain and all that, but as a consequence of, this is the Buddha's teaching, as a consequence of having a human life, suffering arises.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Right.
And the how it arises is unimportant. Mm-hmm. And even if we might be able to point out things that we did to cause that pain, in my case, it's still impersonal. And the other thing that's interesting about it, right now, if I think about it, I will, now I do, I can have the visceral experience of what it was like to fall off that. I can feel it right now. What it was like, the 2.5 hours it took to land on a concrete pad 8 feet down, and I can feel the experience. I had a burst fracture of L1, and I could feel the burst, the explosion throughout my whole body.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like my whole body was just kind of turned to mush all at once and crunched up into a little ball, and it just expressed itself. I don't know how else to describe it. I can still feel that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not real.
Right.
So
there's no reality at all to what I just described. Mm-hmm. Even though it's probably pretty close to what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not real?
It is real though, John.
It's just a thought.
It's just a thought now. That's the point.
It's a descriptive thought of
yes.
Now reliving it. It isn't.
Yeah.
Really live.
Yes. Sure.
And if I continue to cling to it, I haven't thought about what I just described in years and years and years, but if I continue to rehash it, what am I doing?
Right.
I am recreating a fake pain
mm-hmm.
and making it real in this present moment. Mm-hmm. And whether it's the mental anguish that follows, or, you know, we can create pain in our bodies just by our thoughts too. It's all a fabrication, and that's the whole point I'm making. I hope this was a useful story to explain that.
Yeah, I think we're done with this story.
Okay.
Now, because I'm going to take this home with me.
Well, let me tell you about the time I was on this horse.
No.
You're talking to a room of empaths.
Talk about feeling your pain.
Yeah.
Right.
On the sutta itself, there's three forms of stress. They all three point to one of the three marks of existence.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure.
A great insight there.
Hmm.
And again, we're gonna spend more time on dukkha over the next 4 weeks. This is where it resolves, in here. And in our experiences, in our thoughts, in our fabrications, in our physical body feeling pain. So the same human being now, free of all that, guess what? I still have physical pain. I'm hopefully free of fabrications, at least over the physical pain. And that the change simply is not important. It's just noticed. It's just what's occurring.
There's not reduced stress.
It's just change. It's just going from one moment to the next.
Induced stress. That's a good.
It is. All stress is
induced. Stress
self-induced.
Increases the anxiety, which creates more pain, and so it's like this adding to the dukkha sponge.
Yes,
yeah.
We can live in the world dukkha occurs without contributing that second arrow, without reacting to physical pain, mental pain, or the pain of change.
And if we can create it, we can stop it.
That, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's up to us.
Just to say that...
Well, Kate, I'm going to get to you.
We're talking about pain in the body. It could be... I mean, for instance, I've been moving some soil just lately, wheelbarrowing, and I've absolutely loved the work and feel good and feel strong and all that stuff. And that's just as big a fabrication as feeling pain, you know, that to get high from feeling good is just, you know, it's a difficult one. This centering around the body.
There's a subtle...
Yeah, you feel great.
There's a subtlety there that resolves in right or wrong intention. So there's nothing wrong at all. In fact, I would encourage anybody that is enjoying moving dirt around with a wheelbarrow to continue to do so. If you make that a requirement for your happiness, that's where you get into trouble.
Right.
You know, so tomorrow it rains and you were planning all day to get out and move some more dirt. Now you're disappointed because of that fabrication.
Yeah, but when you feel that good, it's I feel great. I feel great.
That's okay.
Again, it is okay as long as you're not putting a condition on that. It's important to recognize that in this moment, I'm free of whatever. I'm just enjoying the moment. I'm enjoying running wheelbarrows up and down a hill. That's great. As long as your life doesn't depend on it. As long as it's not a distraction in your life. And in that way, the whole process of life is simply meaningful because you're present for it.
Well, therefore, I don't see the distinction of pain and pleasure. Having pleasure in your body when you feel great, and you have a pleasure for...
Same
why
thing.
Is that not a fabrication and feeling pain from a cut?
It all has to do with how you're thinking is in relation to what's occurring. If you're taking it personal, I think the difficulty is having an experience of enjoyment and wondering or alluding to the fact that this must be eye making when it's simply enjoying what's occurring. It doesn't take an ego personality to notice in this moment something pleasurable is occurring, and there's nothing wrong or contradictory to that. It's simply being present. Just like there's nothing wrong with feeling sadness when you hear a loved one died. You would be literally mentally ill if you were joyful over it. It's appropriate to feel sadness. The Buddha taught in the Vittakasanthana Sutta that we think what we want to think when we want to think it, when it's appropriate. So if I'm enjoying running wheelbarrows of dirt around, notice that you're enjoying it. There's no eye making in that. But if you need to continue to do it, or if somebody takes your wheelbarrow and runs away and you're disappointed, there's your eye making. Again, kind of silly examples, but there's a difference. It's very subtle, Lorna, but the Buddha's not teaching that we should never enjoy ourselves, or we should never have a negative, so-called negative emotion. He simply teaches us to not create false identities over them and not cling those identities to certain situations. Like, I can't live without my wheelbarrow.
Yeah, and if you would push it on a day beyond what is actually good for your body, you'll find out where the fabrication is.
That's right. It's a good point, though, because you enjoy it so much, let me keep doing it, and you end up hurting yourself over it. That's a practical example of eye-making contributing to stress and suffering.
I love splitting firewood, but I know now that if I go beyond a quarter cord at a time, I'm
going to
hurt myself.
I like a good glass of vodka. In fact, I like a bad glass of vodka. But because it makes me feel good, and my mind is rooted in ignorance of the actual occurrence of what happens when you have 40 glasses of bad vodka, there's the problem. But we do this with everything. Again, I use that because it's a personal example, but it's a good example of what we do with compulsive thoughts. We simply want more of it. So someone who has lost their mind might decide that wheelbarrow felt so good, let me do it. Let me see if I can do it for 48 hours straight, and you break up your body over it. So I would say if you enjoy doing it, do it. I got a couple of piles of dirt over my
I'm not pushing any more wheelbarrows. I'm not pushing any more wheelbarrows.
Wait a minute.
Yes. Kate, have some. Yes. Jeez.
Good evening, Kate.
Hi. I think one of the things that I've noticed come out of practicing this for a number of months now is that I do have more awareness of my thinking and more insight into it. But I do think that there's like a hump I can't get over, where I'm still reacting to things and I'm still stuck in things. And like I almost look at this as like a complete retraining of my mind.
It is.
It is correcting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a lot of your thinking.
It is.
Yeah. And I find it to be constant that I have to do that. And so I'm just. Like I said, there's just like a hump I can't get over. I still am letting myself become completely wrapped up in, like I can see it. I know. Yep. I'm doing it. I know I'm fabricating something. I know I'm making something more personal than it needs to be, but how can you not make it personal? Like that's still how I see everything is like being personal. Yeah. I don't know.
It's such a great question, Kate, because we've all gone through that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just part of Dhamma practice. There's a gentleman named Anthony DeMello, who is I think he was a Franciscan monk, and he wrote a couple of pretty good books. One was, and I still remember this book, was the book name of the book was Awareness. And I remember a line in there. He says, awareness isn't change, but it gives us the power to change. And what you're describing is the development of an inner awareness of what needs to change. And even though right now it feels like a hump that you can't get over right now, the hump itself is a fabrication. There's nothing, there's no substance to it except the substance that you're giving it. And again, we've all done this. It's not, this isn't something that is peculiar to your Dhamma practice. And the simple answer, the simple solution is if you continue, but that's not a very satisfying answer. I would point out that you are at the nexus of the Dhamma. Lorna explained it in slightly different words. But it's recognizing first that there's something wrong thinking, right thinking. There's something wrong in my thinking. And I need to recognize that pattern of thoughts and simply abandon them because they no longer work. How do we do it? How do we get past that hump? Just as you're doing it, because you're describing developing the Dhamma at the point of contact, where your thoughts are coming in contact with whatever the object of your fabrication is, and whether it's yourself or it's the world around you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but like what's the actual thing you do to abandon those thoughts?
Oh, when you find yourself caught up in that, the simple and direct way at that moment is to just remind yourself, take a breath, wait a minute, this is not me, this is not what I am. And that you're not doing that on faith, because you're doing it on a developed understanding of what reality is and what it isn't. And so that hump you're describing, again, is simply another fabrication. It's an aspect of your conditioned thinking to be recognized and abandoned. Where else could it be? You think about it that way. It's in your mind. And it doesn't mean that the world we live in contributes greatly to our conditioned thinking. It's not just us. We can't help but live in the world, just like Buddha went through the same thing, his conditioning. So you're going through this period of undoing where you're recognizing your own conditioned thinking. And part of the world we live in, part of this analytical world, is we always got to get to the root cause. And so our minds want to find a specific incident where did this conditioning came from. The Buddha realized that, and he showed us a way that we don't have to do that. In fact, that's all just a distraction. It all arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So the resolution is developing wisdom of Four Noble Truths. Suffering occurs, it originates in craving and it's continued through clinging, and it's specifically in ignorant wrong views, craving for and clinging to those views. The struggle, the hump that you're describing, is your actual clinging to something that you're not willing to let go of. But again, this isn't peculiar to you. We've all gone through this, correct?
Yes.
You're describing Dhamma practice. As you continue to deepen your concentration, as you continue what you're doing, your awareness is only going to deepen. And that awareness, as Mr. DeMello said, now gives you the power to change. It gives you the framework. So I hope that helps.
Because you can't change what you can't see.
That's right.
Yeah. I agree that the seeing is the first thing. It's huge. Yeah.
Yeah. Really, you've in a few months, Kate, you've come a long way along the Dhamma. So good for you, and thank you for your contribution to it. Hello, Helen.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Good. Despite all my pain and falling off the roof, and all
pain you can overlook. Well, I keep seeing in bold print the potential for liberation resides in each moment that occurs.
Yes.
And you know, since I'm a visual person, for me, when I get to that point of like, oh, shouldn't have said that, or that probably wasn't right speech, I realize that I've gotten off the path, and I sort of mentally step right back on the path, right in the middle, get myself pointed in the right direction. It's like if you're skiing and you feel like you're out of control, you just have to get your skis pointed in the right direction, and then you're on the path again.
I never got past that point. I got past that mogul.
Right, well, today I was thinking about two little snippets from fairy tales or children's tales. One was about this king and his son, the prince, who would someday be the king. And the son was never satisfied with anything. Nothing was ever good enough. It wasn't the right thing. Why isn't it better? Why isn't it different? And so the wise king decided that he was going to take him on a journey. And the son had the choice. Everyone had to carry something, he said. And so he gave the son a chance to choose what he was going to carry. And he decided he would carry his own bedroll. And he would carry his father's bedroll. And he would carry his clothes. So the father said, okay, well, I will carry the food. So they're going along this journey. And the whole time the son is like, my father's the king. He's the wisest man in the world. Why did he choose to carry the heaviest load? Well, as they're going along, each day they're eating more and more of the food. The father's pack is getting lighter and lighter and lighter. They rest, and in the morning the food is prepared, and the son is, isn't good enough, this isn't good enough. Okay, we go on the next day. This isn't good enough, this isn't good enough. Okay, don't eat it. Until finally the son is really hungry because he's rejected everything. And he finally eats these pancakes and he's like, these are the best pancakes I've ever had. So there's two lessons in there. One is that at any given moment, you can choose which kind of impermanence you want. Like the impermanence of the weight, the father wisely chose, impermanence is good. And you can also choose to accept what is and be grateful for what is, and not always wanting it to be something different. Mm-hmm. So those are two different kinds of ways of looking at the same thing, when permanence is good, or Sleeping Beauty's stepmother who was so caught up with her looks. Well, there's not much more impermanent than looks. Mm-hmm. So there's another thing you don't cling to because every day it's changing. Mm-hmm. So impermanence can be good. It depends on how you look at it. That's what came through my mind.
That was our entire story.
That was, yes.
Thank you. A great story. Thank you.
Her welcome, Ray.
It's a lot nicer than John's story.
What's that?
It's a lot nicer than John's story.
Oh. Hello. How are you, Mary?
I'm good. Really enjoying the series. I like the structure and the focus and the frequency. You know, I like that it's almost like a a version of a retreat, you know, it's like a living retreat because it has more of the focus that we get when we immerse ourselves in a retreat by having two different topics in the same week. If you know, if we can find the time to participate in that. So I love the, you know, the correlation to the three marks, which is seems to be what everything is really all about. And to something Kate said, that, you know, there's times, like there's times you get through like a threshold of awareness and you come out the other side and you're like, wow, this is really great. But it's like that too is impermanent. Yep. You know, you will revisit that, that challenge or that stuckness or whatever, because something, you know, you'll be, I find that I might go on for a very long period of time where things have been even and good, and then something just, something happens that triggers something that you haven't addressed yet, and it needs to be addressed. And it's not that you're stepping backwards, you just, I think it's just like, you know, cleaning house or an attic or something, and there's some, oh look, I didn't know that was over there, and you have to address it. So I think being prepared that that too will happen again, but that with each one of those fabrications or experiences that comes up, we're smarter for it. We have more, we've often, everybody has used the terminology of we have more tools in our toolbox to deal with it. And sometimes we can see it coming, right? That's the awareness that, that Kate mentioned, that we have an awareness. We still feel the arising, but somehow there's more distance between the thing or situation that's coming and your ability to compose yourself.
And your 5-second delay.
Maintain a poise about yourself, even while you are, you know, mentally or physically feeling something, but you are restraining yourself from the reaction. And then when you have those experiences, it's a validation and a direct experience of the Dhamma. So anyway, that's all I have to say about that.
Thank you, Mary. Yeah, that, the poise we develop through the Eightfold Path is what we carry through life now.
Yeah, and even if it's like a semi-forced poise, you know, like, I remember the first time that I just showed a whole lot of restraint in I forget what the environment was, it doesn't really matter, but I just decided not to say anything and to view the experience from that way when I would normally have participated. You know, it's a those are learning moments, you know. Yeah. And so even though that poise, it might have looked like poise to everyone else, but I was really maybe struggling or forcing a certain level of restraint. The reward, if you will, or the direct experience was the outcome that occurred by my lack of participation, and that that was a good thing, and that was that was okay.
Yeah.
It was more refined.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Great insight. Hello, David.
Hi.
Glad you're here. Hello, Bonnie.
Hello, John. Thank you for tonight's teaching.
Glad you're here. Hello, Liz.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
That's good. I think one thing that helps me is when these issues come up, I ask myself, what's the condition of my mind? And that sometimes provokes different reactions depending on where my state of mind is. And the other thing is that it's a, we have to keep reminding ourselves that this is a process. It's not like one day we're going to have held ourselves in restraint for a week and we move up to the next level of the, you know, like Mario Brothers, you know which rock to step on to take you up to the next level. It's a process, and it's not a destination. It's not a thing that's just going to happen one day, and you know, like in the Catholic Church, the idea of penance, you know, you do so many, you do what the priest tells you to do when you go to confession and you're going to reach some new level of holiness or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a process, and there are going to be times when it's tested, when we think we have it down pat and it's tested. And then it's just a matter of being gentle with ourselves, admitting our humanness, and finding that point of departure where you can sort of reset. And that's the nice thing, and I say this almost every week, but it's the looping around of the Eightfold Path that allows us to pick up where we need to pick up and to start over and to reset. Not start over, because we have the benefit of having done this for a while, but the idea that you can pick it up and reset where you are and give yourself forgiveness for having overlooked whatever mistake you decided to make that day by saying the wrong thing or acting the wrong way.
Yeah.
And that's what's really is so great about this is the idea that you know, you can just be kind to yourself, and you have the knowledge now, and you know where to restart, where to pick up where you left off, and not get hung up on, you know, the fact that you've tripped or something's happened. So it's simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah. Thank you, Liz. You're describing the radical acceptance that the Buddha's teaching. You remind me of it. I had a great friend of mine. His name was Robert Wolf, and he wrote this great book called What It Is to Be Human. It doesn't have a lot to do with Buddhism, but the title reflects what we're doing. We're learning what it's like to be a human being,
mm-hmm.
period. But it's a pretty big period. Maybe it should be an exclamation point. This is what, as far as we are concerned anyway, as Dhamma practitioners, this is our life. This is what our human life is. And ours is devoted towards awakening. And along the way, we get to have some incredible experience of elation and pain and doubt and joy. Little bits of understanding along the way, sometimes great understandings. This is what it is to be human. Russ, good to see you tonight.
Be here. I don't have much to say because Helen took my story out.
You are adorable. That is a good one.
You got to start practicing restraint by what you're telling Helen.
That is funny.
Very good, Russ.
I'm good. Thank you.
Might as well end on a high note. Thank you, Russ. Michael, good to see you.
Thank you, John. I got a lot of clarity tonight just by being here and listening to everyone.
Yeah.
When Maura was speaking there, and in relation to, you know, your incident, okay, that you had some time ago, I think that really kind of sums up a lot, okay? It's not me, it's not mine, it's not who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Pain and suck. The pain is there, but it's not who we are. And I just thought that was a good way of making me understand it better, actually.
Good. Yeah. That is. That's the dollar. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Julia, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Thank you for everything. And I want to tell everybody good night. I guess you got myself saying that. I'm at the end of the line here. Yeah, thank you, John.
Thank you, Julia. Thank you all for being such a happy song. I mean, it is. Life is absurd. And applying the Dhamma to it really shines a light on the absurdity of life. But this is what it is to be human.
And John, just one more thing, for emphasis, is, and I think we say this all the time, but, you know, I mean, it can be hard to maintain a practice, right? To have the diligence and the rigor to maintain it twice a day, every day, and not let anything else interfere. But it absolutely is critical to the expansion of your concentration. Like, I don't know how I could continue to improve my concentration without the practice of sitting twice a day. And I just wanted to emphasize that it all comes, the expansion of thought comes through concentration. Yeah. The concentration is born on your cushion.
Yeah. Thank you so much for emphasizing that. It is. We can't do, it's an eightfold path, but it all rests on a developing well-concentrated mind. But it's also part of the Dhamma, you know, that and our classes and our retreats reflect just that. We meditate, but we don't, you know, we also talk about and integrate the Dhamma. When I first started, there was a small group of folks that were practitioners of another lineage. I don't have to say what. And over a period of time, they began complaining about, they don't want to hear all this talk. They want to just come and meditate. And my only response was, well, then you need to go someplace else. Not to be rude, but that's not Dhamma practice. And eventually they did stop coming. But there's many people that think that meditation is some magic tool that all you got to do is do it and somehow you're going to be fixed too. It's not. But as Mary said, that twice a day, every day, no matter what your length of time is so important. It's critical. It can't be done without it. So thank you, Mary. Thank you all for a wonderful class. I think Jane is still left. Jane, thank you for joining us tonight. Maura is left already. She gets up early, probably went to bed. We'll finish with metta as we always do. And just again, just so you know what's coming up, I did change the schedule. Has anybody been following the schedule, the structured study schedule,
No.
Referencing it? Well, impermanence has intervened. I did make some slight changes. This Saturday was going to be a sutta from Sister Vajira that will now be after our suttas on dukkha, because I just wanted to kind of group these together, and also with the retreat, I didn't want to have something, the studies on dukkha specifically split up. So we're going to spend next Saturday and next Tuesday on the Maha Dukkha Kanda Sutta, and then right after retreat, that Tuesday and Saturday, we'll review the Kula Dukkha Kanda Sutta. And we'll have a profound understanding of what this is. All three of these suttas on dukkha are interesting because they're the slight variations in subject matter is quite interesting. All right, we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditation. Wait a minute. How come I... You know, I should have the words to metta, but I don't memorize. So, hold on. Let me try something. Well, maybe, folks.
We can go back to the one that you did.
I don't know if I remember it anymore. It's been so long.
You were filled with loving kindness. You were well. You were peaceful and at ease.
Let me try it. Let me see if I remember it.
May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well.
May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. So we'll do that. We'll do that modified version. So again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And may I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease, and may I be happy. And now bring to mind those you care deeply for, and generating those same feelings of loving kindness. May they be filled with loving kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with loving kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. And may they be happy. And now bring to mind those you may be in conflict with, difficult relationships. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. And may they be happy. And now bring to mind each other in this room this evening. And extend your awareness outside of this room, into our community, across our planet, across all creation, and holding in mind those same feelings of love and compassion for all sentient beings. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.